You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, an epidemiologist shares what she's doing this holiday season to protect vulnerable loved ones from flu, RSV, and COVID. Now, it seems like you can't get through a live broadcast of a sporting event these days without seeing or hearing some kind of advertisement for sports betting, like these.
It's easy. All you have to do is download it, make a deposit, pick a sport, place a bet. Boom, goes the dynamite. Out comes the cash. Simple.
The buzzer beats, the walk-off blast, and every Hail Mary pass is one tap away from you doing your victory dance.
Now you're in the ring with the king of sportsbooks.
And that's how you do more than just bet. That's how you live your bet life.
In Wisconsin, you can legally bet on sporting events if you go in person to one of a few select tribal casinos. But all you have to do is step across the state line into, say, Illinois, Iowa, or Michigan. Your cell phone turns into a full-service sports book in your pocket. That comes after the U.S. Supreme Court ended a federal ban on online betting a few years ago, leaving it up to states. For some gamblers, sports betting can become a powerful addiction that has severe consequences in their lives. Our next guest says it's important to know the warning signs of problem sports gambling and the resources available to help. Mary Drexler is the director of the Maryland Center of Excellence on Problem Gambling at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. She wrote a recent column in the Washington Post sharing advice to keep online sports gambling under control. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob, for having me.
Can you talk about the game changer, the availability of online sports betting in so much of the country now? How has that affected the amount people gamble and the risk of addiction?
Yeah, well, I think as it rolls out, and you know it's been rolling out nationally, there's greater opportunity, convenience to bet, especially with sports. Individuals think, you know, I know my favorite team, so I'm going to know how to bet, that they have an edge on it. And people need to be careful about that. And it poses even bigger risks, risks to one's mental health, not just the financial risks that are involved there. You know, a lot of people, the adverse consequences with online sports betting, which it does appear that, individuals will make bigger bets or more bets and thus end up with bigger losses compared to with in-person bettors. You can do it from your living room couch. All the way through the game, we're not just betting on who wins right now or who loses. We're betting on plays within the game. So some of these consequences can be anxiety, depression. You're not focusing on work anymore. You're starting to have financial problems and strained relationships.
How do we know when, you know, maybe harmless sort of gambling, whether it's going to a casino for sports betting or online or a fantasy pool with friends, say, is turning into a problem?
Well, I think one of the things is, are you preoccupied with your gambling? Are you thinking about it all day? Can't wait to place bets online? Constantly planning gambling activities, being focused on getting more money to gamble. These are all signs that could have a negative impact on your daily life. Also, do you have some withdrawal symptoms? A lot of gamblers will say they tried to stop or cut back, but couldn't do it. And some of these symptoms could be emotional, irritable, depressed. You even get physical symptoms, sweating, headaches, tension. Another one might be, are you hiding that activity? Gamblers are very good at hiding their gambling activity. So, you know, they lose money. They end up trying to borrow more money, but they cover everything with lies. And these lies have destroyed many of the relationships a gambler may have with their family and friends. And then this family member also is having to deal with the consequences of the behavior of the gambler. They'll even hide, they'll run to the mailbox to get the bills or the bank statements so a family member doesn't know what's happening.
It's easy to look in from the outside and say, well, just stop if it's a problem. I'm guessing, as with any kind of a compulsive or addictive behavior, that's easier said than done. What does it take to break a serious gambling addiction like this?
Well, I think first and foremost, the person needs to seek out help. There is help in all the states that have legalized gambling in those states. And there is the National Helpline for problem gambling. Right now it's 1-800-522-4700, and that's the National Council on Problem Gambling. Here in Maryland, our helpline number is 1-800-GAMBLER, and you can text or chat, because that is the way of the world now. More people aren't making calls, but they're texting or chatting for help. Maryland is one of the states across this country that has no cost treatment. So if you are a gambler with a problem, you can actually see a counselor at no cost to you, regardless of your income or insurance. And that in Maryland, you can also get that treatment as a family member because you're impacted by the gambling behavior. I am very happy here, and I think some other states have it as well. We have peer recovery support specialists who are on staff at the Maryland Center of Excellence on Problem Gambling. These are individuals with lived experience. Sometimes the gambler doesn't really want to go directly into counseling, but wants to talk to someone who's been there and has made it through and is in recovery. So those are some of the recommendations, but you have to connect with people. You need to talk about it.
Now, suppose we're seeing this in a family member, a loved one, or a close friend, mm-hmm. say, are there ways to intervene, to help?
Yes. There are support groups for family members. Gammonon is one, which is national. Many states have Gammonon, and those are for the family members of a person who has a gambling problem. That's probably the primary, but they can call helplines across the different states. They can also provide them with some counseling alternatives because sometimes the gambler is not ready to get the help does not mean that the family member should not seek out that help.
Do you have concerns about how this new wave of sports betting is being online sports betting is being marketed and maybe finding its way to audiences that it shouldn't?
Yeah, well, we know that it is a younger demographic typically with sports betting. That 18 to 24. But, you know, we also know that between 11 and 18 years old, young adult males are gambling. And the younger you start your gambling behavior, the more apt you are to have a gambling problem as you get older. So, the target population is definitely there on college campuses. We're already starting to hear on our helpline some college students who've lost their money, maxed out their credit cards, thinking they were going to get that big win and just got drawn into the ease of being able to bet online.
Mary, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
I thank you.
That's Mary Drexler, Director of the Maryland Center of Excellence on Problem Gambling at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, with us today to share warning signs of sports gambling addictions, how we can help loved ones who might be struggling with it, with the rise of online sports gambling in many states around the country, not Wisconsin, at least not yet. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story from the world of music.
Imagine making it as a musician not only once, but at two distinct moments in your life. That's what happened to jazz saxophonist Frank Morgan of Milwaukee. Author Dean Robbins brings us the story on the musician's rebirth and stardom.
Frank Morgan grew up in Milwaukee, playing jazz guitar at an early age. But in 1940, his father took 7-year-old Frank to see a concert by alto saxophonist Charlie Parker. The experience changed his life. The minute Morgan heard Parker's starkly beautiful sound, he knew that alto sax was his destiny. He and his father went backstage to meet the genius who'd helped create the modern jazz style called bebop. With typical generosity, Parker took an interest in the boy and got him started on a reed instrument. Morgan became his protege, copying the master's jagged melodies and quicksilver rhythms. At 14, Frank was sitting in with top jazz players in Los Angeles. And at 22, when he released his debut album, word spread that Frank Morgan might become the next Charlie Parker. But it didn't happen. In the mid-1950s, Morgan succumbed to drug addiction, just as Parker had. His heroin habit led to a life of crime, and he spent most of the next 30 years behind bars. Instead of becoming a jazz celebrity, he performed for fellow inmates in the San Quentin prison band. Here he is on WHYY's Fresh Air in 1987.
In prison, the instrument was the thing that kept me sane, if you will. And the chance to play it, you know, kept me with hope.
After his release in 1985, Morgan finally recorded a second album, drawing on decades of pent-up emotion. Since prison had isolated him from a generation's worth of musical changes, listeners got the impression that a pure 1950s bebop pioneer had been magically transplanted to the 1980s. Morgan's resurrection fascinated the public, and his friendly smile began beaming out of magazines and TV screens. Audiences were touched by his sublime improvisations. He expressed gratitude for his long-delayed fame and committed himself to earning people's respect.
I really intend to play, and to play my heart out.
That meant staying off drugs, of course, which required extraordinary effort. To avoid temptation, Morgan threw himself into practicing and recording. He also moved back to Milwaukee in 1994 to be with supportive family members. I had a chance to interview Morgan after his return to Wisconsin, a state he dubbed pretty hip. He credited Milwaukee with giving him a great start in music, and the city's schools with providing an excellent education. And he was overwhelmed by the warm welcome he received from local jazz fans. I was one of those fans. I saw Morgan play a spectacular concert in Madison, and continued to follow his career until he died from cancer in 2007 at age 73. His final years are one of the greatest second acts in jazz history, and his recordings endure as a testament to redemption and rebirth. Here he is on NPR's Piano Jazz.
Well, it's great to be alive, you know. Every day is beautiful.
In our interview, Morgan explained his musical strategy of channeling everything he felt through his horn. His goal, he said, was to make a direct connection between his heart and a listener's heart. I'd say, mission accomplished.
Author Dean Robbins of Madison brought us that story on saxophonist Frank Morgan. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, an epidemiologist shares steps you can take to protect vulnerable loved ones amid the triple-demic, flu, COVID, RSV, during the holiday season. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, even though many people have dropped pandemic precautions, the pandemic is still happening, along with a surge of other potentially severe respiratory illnesses. Hospitalizations for flu-like illnesses, flu, RSV, COVID, and other respiratory viruses are higher than they've been in the last decade, and nearly 2,000 people are still dying from COVID-19 each week here in the U.S. As winter holidays get closer, there are a lot of things we can do to protect people who are at risk for complications and death, including older adults, younger children, people with underlying medical conditions. Caitlin Jedalina is the founder and author of the newsletter Your Local Epidemiologist, Director of Population Health Analytics at Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute. Caitlin, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me again.
Can you give an overview of where we are in the U.S. right now with this combo of multiple respiratory diseases?
Yeah, for actually the first time, the much anticipated and I will say dreaded triple-demic is finally here. RSV, flu, and now COVID-19 are rising together at a national level, and it's not looking very pretty.
And you're concerned in large part this year with people who are vulnerable to illness, these three diseases going around, and we're getting ready to gather for holidays. Who in particular should we be thinking about protecting here?
Yeah, it really depends on the type of virus we're worried about. So, for example, I'm very concerned about those over 65. They are at high risk for RSV, they're at high risk for flu, and they're at high risk for COVID-19. And the main reason for that is because they just have weakened immune systems. The more we grow older, the more weak our immune systems get. So they could be doing everything. They could have their fall COVID-19 booster, they could have the flu shot, and still not be well protected against these viruses, particularly against severe disease. The other group that I'm particularly concerned about are those under five, kids under 5 years old. specifically for RSV. Also, we know flu and COVID-19 is no walk in the park for them either. And so there's a lot of viruses circulating right now. And I think going into the holidays, everyone really needs to plan around their most vulnerable family member.
You, in one of your recent local epidemiologist newsletter, gave a series of steps to take. And starting there and earliest is vaccination, the latest boosters, the flu shot. Could you make the case that if people haven't done those, they ought to do them now?
That's right. I mean, it's truly, I think, one of the lowest hanging fruits. You have to get it and you don't necessarily need to think about it again. You know, if you got your last COVID-19 vaccine a year ago, 2 years ago, it's running out of batteries. It's just without a recent booster, you're not really technically protected. And so that is incredibly important. And I think one of the easier things to do this season, just keep in mind that time is running out. I mean, if, you know, Christmas is only 3 weeks away. And so it takes a few weeks for that booster to kick in. So I would certainly get it as soon as possible.
And then masking. In general, I think, are masking less than we used to. This would be the time. Could you talk about your masking plans leading up to, say, holiday gatherings?
Yeah, that's right. You know, I mean, just go outside. Very few people are wearing an N95 mask anywhere. But the way I think about it is put on that mask 1 week prior to the event. 1 week prior to Christmas, for example, wear that mask everywhere you go in public, because that will not only help ensure that you don't get sick, so you don't miss the holiday spirits and seeing Santa Claus, et cetera, but that also helps break transmission chains to those vulnerable people. It helps ensure you won't bring the virus to the little kiddos or to grandma or grandpa.
And before we get to the next step, I mean, part of your goal here is that we can gather, that we don't have to cancel those holiday plans, right? That's what we're working toward here.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think we've all sacrificed enough the past 2.5 years. And I think that it's a big quality of life is getting together with family and friends, especially during the holiday season. I just really want to ensure, at least the way I'm thinking about it, is we want to do it in the most safe and most healthy way we can. And we can do that. We have lots of ways to do that.
Talking to epidemiologist Caitlin Jedalina about keeping our gatherings safe from COVID and RSV and flu this holiday season. Okay, testing is also part of your plan. We've got home tests out there. What is the testing regimen you are looking toward?
That's right. So we have testing at least for COVID-19 at home, right? So we don't have flu and RSV tests at home, but we can use them for COVID-19. And the way I kind of see it as certainly do it if you have symptoms the day or the morning of the event, but also do it even if you're asymptomatic. Do it the morning of the event and a few days before. This is called cadence testing. So testing a few days in a row. And the reason why this is good is because it gives you more likelihood of catching asymptomatic virus. Antigen tests aren't perfect at catching asymptomatic virus, about 44 to 70% of cases it'll catch. But if we do it multiple times, we have higher chances of catching it if we do truly are infected.
And if we test positive just that few days before the event?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it means you're probably going to have to stay home. I mean, I certainly would stay home if you have symptoms, no matter if it's COVID or something else. That is literally the best thing you can do for your family. If you test positive a few days before on a COVID antigen test, I will say that it could be that you're just at the end of their infection. So I would highly suggest testing again that morning of. Just be prepared that you won't be going there. But you may get lucky and it may come out negative and you can go to the holiday celebration.
All right. Great news. We're all clean. We're getting together. What are things we can do at the event to help lower the risk of transmission in case something snuck in with somebody?
Ventilation and filtration are really powerful tools. This is especially important in the middle of winter when we head indoors. So get that air moving, get the air conditioning moving. You can have a fan going. If it's nice outside, open those windows. It'll actually do quite a lot. And then again, of course, at the day of the event, if you have symptoms, just stay home. I know this is lonely during the holidays, but it's truly the best thing to do.
And yeah, that's kind of a mindset thing. Everybody's going to be, or many people, I should say, will be bummed to miss a holiday gathering. Can you give us some encouragement to do it if we need to in just our last minute?
I keep saying this, but it's literally the best thing you can do for the vulnerable, those under 5, those over 65, but not only those, it'll help the community as well. Our healthcare systems are incredibly stressed right now. So please stay home, binge watch some Netflix. There's always going to be next Christmas.
Caitlin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you again for having me.
That's Caitlin Jedalina, founder and author of the newsletter Your Local Epidemiologist, director of population health analytics at Meadows Mental Health Policy Institute. She talked to us today about steps we can take to keep at-risk people safe during the upcoming holiday gathering season in the midst of increases in numbers for COVID, flu, and this RSV virus that's out there. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, alcohol accounts for a large share of deaths of working age Americans, up to 1 in 4 for the age range 20 to 34. That's according to numbers from the CDC. We'll tackle the problem and possible solutions, and you can join in with your questions for our guest, a public health expert, maybe your own experiences. And this will be interesting. It's okay to go out and do things on your own. Our guest says, in fact, we should plan for it. We can make dates for one. So even if you have somebody to hang out with, the guest makes the case that it's worth it to take time for yourself, make special plans for yourself, do stuff solo out there, and don't feel weird about, for example, being at that restaurant with a table for one. That and more, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it's the season of giving. A philanthropic advisor tells us about how to give back during the winter and beyond. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Japanese forces attacked Americans at Pearl Harbor on this day in 1941, leading the U.S. to enter World War II. We learned about America's ambassador to Tokyo at the time and his experience in the lead-up to the war. First, the holiday season is a time of celebration, gift-giving, and often giving back to our communities. Sometimes, though, taking that first step toward volunteering or donating can be a little challenging if you don't know where to start. Our next guest is an internationally recognized philanthropic advisor with advice on how to make the most of the giving season. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you like to give back to your own community during the holidays? Do you volunteer? What do you do? What got you started? How do you decide where to make donations this time of year? Do you have questions needing some advice from our guest, maybe? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lisa Dietlin is a keynote speaker, author, and founder of the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy. Lisa, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, we think of this as a season of giving. What are some of the themes or messages you think about a lot during this time of year?
You know, some of the things I think about are how Americans are so focused at this time of year on giving back, and yet philanthropy and need is there 365 days a year. I am so pleased that we have a time of year when we all come together and congregate and say, I want to make a difference. I want to give some money. I want to make sure people have food on their table, or if they're children, maybe a gift under the tree. But I also want to continue that education so that people realize it's not just one and done. It's all year long.
How can people make that mindset shift, maybe instead of that once a year donation, which is also great, or once a year volunteer gig, to say, hey, maybe I'm going to start a habit of doing stuff like this?
Well, you're speaking my language, Rob. You're definitely, you know that, you know that, you teed that up perfectly. You know, first of all, to level set, 80% of nonprofits receive 50% of their budget in the last 2 months of the year. Now imagine, you know, our listeners, if you got, you know, 80% of your salary or 50, you know, 80%, you got 50% of your salary in the last 2 months of the year. You'd be like, wait a minute, I worked all these other months and how do I make it stretch? So actually thinking about how do we make a charitable plan of action? And I think it should be a family affair. I think it's something that we need to teach both those who are older. I've taught my mother and my brother and my sister how to give, and as well as my nieces and nephews. So one of the first things I would say is have a conversation during the holidays, whether it's one-on-one or at the family table or as you're sitting around getting ready to watch that football game or, you know, that holiday special. We always watch the Christmas Story, you know, sitting there and talk about what did you do this year? What did you do to give back? And what's your plan of action? Because sometimes just starting the conversation will motivate the family to begin thinking about, oh yeah, we have been really blessed, or oh yeah, we went through a tough time and people helped us. Maybe we should help them.
Now, we think of giving as a way to help other people. One little secret, and I've heard this from a lot of people in the psychological field. You talk about this in your latest newsletter, Lisa. Giving is a great way to help ourselves, especially maybe for feeling a little seasonal sadness with the sunlight going down and things like that. What are some of the things we get out of doing nice things for others, whether that's donating to a cause or just helping out somebody we know?
Well, you know, it's a great question. And actually, we live in a time when medical and scientific studies have been done, Rob, and there's actually data to show that individuals who volunteer, give back, do something for somebody else actually are happier. They have an instant return on investment. You know, they're happier and they actually are healthier. There's been studies done to show that people who regularly volunteer are actually healthier than those who don't volunteer. Your blood pressure goes down. You get out of the blues, you know, whether they're wintertime blues. I'm a summer blues. You know, I'm a summer baby. And when that sun is bright and shining, everyone's out, I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, and I thought I was crazy. But, you know, you can get out of the blues by helping someone else or doing something. And, you know, it does not have to be formalized or structured. You know, I want to give two examples here. One is a very structured. My family, we, you know, grew. I mean, there's six nieces and nephews and they're married and there's babies and all of this going on. And it just got to be too much. And so what we all do is put in what we would normally spend on a gift for another person. And we do layaway angels. When the economy is tough, as for some people it is right now, we go into a store and we pay off someone's layaway. And so that they can have those items out before the holidays. That's a very structured family commitment that we all look forward to. And we call ourselves, you know, layaway angels. The other thing is that you can just be kind to somebody. You know, you can hold the door open. You can smile. You can shovel their walk. You could rake their leaves if there's still leaves, you know, blowing around, sweep out the garage, what have you. You know, I was just coming back from England and I was on this plane and I was in row 42, Rob. So, you know, I'm in the back of the plane. I am in the back and people are getting on. And first of all, here's a little pet peeve of mine. If you can't put the luggage in the overhead bin, the suitcase is too big, you know, like, fair. So I'm trying to help people and saying to people, take your time. You know, it's okay. You know, just take a deep breath. And when I sat down, the woman behind me said, "Are you a counselor?" Look up at her and I go, "No." And she goes, "You were just so kind to everybody." And I thought, wow, how is just telling people, don't feel rushed, don't feel pressured, you know, until all of us get on the plane, you know, the plane's not going to take off. How is that something that she noticed? And I thought, it's because she hadn't seen it recently, or we've been so isolated during COVID. And sometimes just making a kind word to someone. And this is, you know this too, Rob, about me. I'm a firm believer in karma. Next plane I was on to South Carolina, you know, this gentleman says, "Can I put your luggage up for you?" And I looked at him and I wanted to say no, like I'm an independent woman. And I said, "You know what? No one's asked that in a long time. That would be really nice." And he put my luggage up and I thought, just being kind, I felt good. He felt good. Yeah, you know, it was a good plane ride.
Nice. Lisa Dietlin is with us from the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy. We're talking about giving and volunteering, the seasonal giving season and beyond. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you volunteer? Love to hear about it. What got you started? What keeps you going? How do you make big decisions on donating maybe this time of year or around the year? Flip it around. Do you work at an organization that depends on donations or volunteers? What do you see this time of year? What do you need? What would help you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. All right, Lisa, let's talk about making decisions on who to give, first of all, money to. Now, people might look out and see these headlines about 7-digit, 10-digit donations that really wealthy people make and thinking, you know, I can't make a difference with my giving. I know you don't buy that mindset. How can we say, how can we take our limited resources and give in a way that's effective and you know, that supports our values?
Right. Well, the first thing I always say is every dollar counts. So please don't think that your $5, your $10 doesn't count. If you have a faith basis, you know, there's a story in the Bible that talks about the coin of least value and, you know, a person giving of their need, not of their excess. So, you know, every dollar, every penny counts because it helps somebody else. The second thing is determine what's important to you. I often recommend look back over the last year. You know, at this time of year, Rob, we often are reflecting. You know, we're looking forward, but we're looking back like what happened in the last year. Did your mom get breast cancer? Did your sister adopt a dog? Did your aunt, you know, go into a senior living facility? What happened in your family that suddenly became very important to you? Did somebody get diagnosed with a rare disease? Did you become aware of something that you weren't aware of before? And see where that stacks up with your priorities. I often say give a larger amount to fewer organizations. So say you had $100, I might give $250 donations instead of $10 to 10 organizations. But that's my personal preference. Some people might say, well, you know, I have 10 organizations I want to give to. So first of all, determine what's important to you. Review what you did last year, because sometimes we forget. What did I give to last year? Oh, yeah, that's important. My kid's school, my house of worship, my alma mater. And then set a budget. You can't save the world, but you can help a little bit. You can help somebody and you can make a difference. And then put a plan of action together for the next year. Are you going to give some money away every month? Are you going to give your time away? You know, the most precious commodity all of us have is our time. It's the one thing we can't replace. How about volunteering a couple hours a month? And taking your mom with you. If your mom's like mine saying, you never spend time with me, or getting your kids in the act, you know, hey, I want you to see how fortunate you are. Let's go and walk the dogs at the dog shelter. No, we're not getting a dog, but we can walk the dogs, you know, make it a family affair.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Dennis is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What are you up to, Dennis?
I am right now driving across Green Bay going to the Red Cross Center to pick up a van and volunteer to drive to Marinette, Wisconsin and pick up blood from a blood drive and bring it back to Green Bay so that it gets sent to Madison for processing through the Red Cross.
Fantastic, Dennis. That is a great work, very much appreciated. And that is a great way to volunteer, Lisa.
Absolutely. I was going to say, Dennis, is it your first time doing this or are you a regular?
I'm a regular. I'm a regular platelet donor. I donate platelets about 22 times a year for people in cancer treatment. And then I also drive for the Red Cross and I work as a donor ambassador, which I'm doing tomorrow in Marinette also to help them out because they don't have any volunteers up there to work at a blood drive at a corporation in Marinette and greet the donors coming in, get them all checked in and give them snacks when they're done.
That's great. You know what, Dennis, when the COVID started, I decided that I was going to become a blood donor and I just got my 1-gallon pin. So I'm right there with you, my friend.
Thank you so much for sharing that great story, Dennis. We are talking to Lisa Dietlin with the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy with us today to talk about the importance of giving back during the holidays and beyond and how you can get started. donating money, donating your time and talent, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your own experiences, how you make decisions about how to give, your questions for our guest, 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with philanthropic advisor Lisa Dietlin about giving back during the holiday season and beyond. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story about volunteering, your own or someone you know that you want to give a shout out to, how do you make decisions of who to donate limited resources to this time of year or in your year-round giving? Do you have an experience on the other side of things, needing volunteers for the cause, the organization you work for? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest, how does she balance or consider the difference between providing labor or money to a charity and trying to get legislation passed so that government can provide more help to those in need?
What are your thoughts, Lisa?
Oh, that's a great question, Tom. Thanks for asking that. You know, the nonprofit sector evolved out of a rich tradition in this country where we didn't have a monarch or a state religion to go to. And so there is that whole side of it that just goes it alone. There's also those nonprofits that fill in the gap that the government isn't able to fill when we do soup kitchens, for instance, and feeding hungry people. I think there's a multi-pronged approach, and I think everyone has to do what they feel is important. You know, many nonprofits advocate, some are even lobby legislators for changes in the law and for more dollars to be directed toward the nonprofit sector. I don't think we'll ever get away from fundraising and donating our time. I think that's just in our DNA, Tom. That's how we were founded, you know, with our the great philanthropic story in the United States of America. But if you're one of those who are going to your legislature and advocating or writing your senators and your congresspeople, I'd say keep at it, because the need always surpasses the resources that are available. And that's the toughest part. If you've ever worked at a food bank and you've handed out that last box and there's, you know, five cars left, if you're like me, you're wondering like, oh my gosh, where can I get food for these people? Because they just happen to be the last five cars. So I think it's a balancing act would be the short answer.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page from Brandy, who says, my main client is a homeless shelter in Milwaukee. I do get paid, but I also do pro bono work. I put so much energy in because I believe in their mission and that they're actually helping. And that's a thought. People donating their talent, if they have unique skills that, you know, they might be how they make a living, donating those to organizations in need, Lisa.
Absolutely. You know, that if you're a lawyer, an attorney, if you're a graphic artist, if you're an accountant, you know, those are skills that might be needed at a nonprofit organization that you could go in. If you're an architect and they're wanting to build a new building, you could donate your services and they're valued. You know, nonprofits have gotten very astute and we actually track and value hours of volunteers, and they're valued differently. I served on the board of a legal aid clinic in Chicago, and we valued the time and the donated time of lawyers different than, you know, someone like me who comes in and answers the phone or does intake of clients that needed the services, the legal aid services. So usually when you're working for a nonprofit, you also volunteer some time and you get your friends and family involved too. So that's a great thing that Brandy's doing.
We are talking about giving in this holiday season and beyond. Lisa Dietlin is with us, expert on giving and philanthropy. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your own experiences. We heard from CK, who wants to encourage people to support their local health departments, especially for those with disabilities and people with eye injuries, because they're often under-helped, under-supported. I'll throw in a thank you to the people who volunteer to read for Bard. My dad has come to depend on it with some vision changes for audiobooks. Lisa, what do you think of that as a way, as a place to look for an opportunity to volunteer?
I think it's great. You know, there's so many ways. And if you have access to the internet, simply doing a Google search or contacting your local community foundation. If you don't have the internet, making a phone call, you know, checking in with your city hall or your county officials. They know where the need is in your community. And there's a lot of things that we learned during the COVID pandemic, which, you know, as we know, is still going on. But we got smarter about how we can volunteer and how we can engage people. It's not always that you have to leave your home and go to a facility. There are things that people can do to help nonprofit organizations from their home.
Lisa, people might wonder if they're looking to give money now specifically, how can I make sure that I'm giving to a legitimate organization that's doing the good work that I assume they're doing when I send them my money?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I always cringe because I say if people would only use their force for good, because you can get tripped up and end up accidentally donating to a fraudulent website that looks like the real website. So first of all, I never respond to anything that comes into my inbox. And I know a lot of development officers are probably cringing in nonprofits like, oh my gosh. What I do is if it interests me, I search that on the internet to find the website and make sure it's real. I might place a call. I might send an email. I might start small with a donation. Those are all safeguard measures. And they're actually best practices of those individuals that at the top of the show, Rob, that you talked about, that give large gifts. Sometimes they'll just give a $50 gift to see if it's processed and if they get a thank you note and if it really went to where it was supposed to be. And I think we all have to take a page out of the Mackenzie Scott book. You know, Mackenzie Scott is making transformational gifts all over the country with no strings attached. And I think there has to be some faith that nonprofits know where the resources, the leadership knows where the resources should go. That said, we do have to have checks and balances. So if you're serving on a board of directors or if you're working on a staff of a nonprofit, make sure those checks and balances are there, because I truly believe that when nonprofits get tripped up because of embezzlement or bad behavior, it's because something's happening in an individual staff member's life that hasn't been addressed, that they're not sharing, and this is the only way they think they can fix it. So I think we have to have some trust and move away from the I need to control the gift where it goes, and hopefully trust that those nonprofits in our community are doing good.
And one place where you differ from some of those, you know, advisors we can look up online, you think it's okay if there are decent salaries for workers at nonprofit. You don't view that necessarily as a bad sign.
Absolutely. You know what? I'm going to talk to Joe Biden at the White House, and you know, I've got a posse going and say, you know, there needs to be a living wage for nonprofit workers. You know, it's we're not volunteers. The nonprofit sector, Rob, you've heard me say this, is the third largest employment sector in this country after retail and manufacturing. More people work in this field than work in the automotive industry, oil and gas, or electronics. Yet until very recently, nobody grew up and said, hey, mom and dad, I want to work in the nonprofit, the charitable sector. And they need to be paid a living wage. You shouldn't be paying them a wage that forces them to go down the street to be in the food bank line, the soup kitchen line, because you're not paying them a sustainable wage. And we as community have to understand that separating out salaries from program and thinking we're being astute donors is not. I mean, could you live? I had this one friend and she would say to me, oh, Lisa, I don't give to a charity that spends more than 3% on overhead. And I said, well, then you're a fool. And she looked at me and said, could you and your husband live on 3% of your salary, on 3% of your income that's coming in? She goes, no. I said, then how are you expecting a nonprofit to do that? And I can tell you they're bearing it. They're bearing it under education. They're bearing it under marketing. Let's trust the nonprofit. Let's pay people a living wage. Or a recent term that I learned, Rob, is a family sustaining wage. Let's pay people a wage that they can do good. At that legal aid clinic I worked at, we would pay, and now this is about 15 years ago, entry level attorneys that were doing family housing, criminal law, family law, we would pay them under $40,000 a year. They wanted to work in the public sector, but guess what? 12 months later, their law school bills came due and they left us. And I remember we said, we need to pay them. We can't pay them what the law firms are paying them, but we can do better than under $40,000 a year.
Lisa, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, always happy to talk about one of my favorite subjects. And no matter what you do, whether it be with your time, with your blood, your sweat, or your dollars, just know you're making a difference. And even a smile or a kind word can change somebody's life.
That's Lisa Dietlin with the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy talking about giving back during the holiday season and beyond. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.